very quick, simple overview of who we are. If you want to hear the whole story, it is on YouTube on my channel, Rhonda Calhoun. Type it in, and the whole story's there. But when Danny and I got married October 17, 1976, I asked him, if money was no object, what would you do with your life? And he really quickly answered. He said, oh, that's easy to answer. He said, I'd buy a farm and I'd build homes for women and kids that are in crisis. And I was blown away because when I was around 12, I asked my mom why she didn't leave my abusive, in every way, alcoholic father. And she said to me, Rhonda, I have no job, no money, no car, five kids, and nobody to help me. So where would I go and what would I do? And I thought I was going to die when she said that, because that meant I was stuck with this man. I was around 12 or 13. I can't remember exactly. And I went out in the field behind her house in South Georgia. I had a place I would go and meet with God. It was my safe place, secret place. And I cried my heart out and exhausted myself and said to him, God, when I grow up, I want to have a place for moms and kids like us that have no money that they can come and get the help they need. I hadn't told Danny that. So when on our honeymoon, I asked him that question, and he said, oh, I'd buy a farm and we're women and kids. I was blown away. You know, we taught our daughters, hey, ask that question before you get married, you know. But so when we realized we had the same dream, we committed to pray every day and ask God to give us that dream that we both had. So fast forward 30 years later, God was building us. He was making us. He was doing in us what needed to be done and to be able to give this place to us. And so long story, really short, in about 3 months' time, I'm not sure exactly. The Lord had given Danny and I a dream in 2006, separately, that he's told both of us that in 2007 he was going to give us that farm we'd been asking for. So then we were already in full-time ministry serving the poor and ministering to the poor, the widows, the orphans. We've been doing that since 95. Yahweh pushed us out of our jobs and dropped us right into full-time ministry and loved it. So this was about 10 years after that. And we were all excited. And so fast forward 2007, we know he's going to give us the farm, wherever, whatever. And our realtor, who was also on our intercessory team, found this place. And she brought me the sheet, and she said, Rhonda, I think I've found the farm. And we were thinking about 20 acres, you know. And this was advertised as 45 acres. 325, I'm sorry. Numbers are not my thing. Except 3 and 7. Those are my thing. So 325 acres, and I read the spec sheet, and it said $1.6 million, and I looked at Elizabeth, and I said, we were thinking $200,000, you know, what? She said, no, it'd be perfect, and I was like, okay, whatever. Well, long story short, again, the Lord supernaturally visited us and said, that farm is the one that I've picked out and chosen, and I'm going to give it to you. So in about 3 months' time, again, long story short, we had hardly any money. It's a great faith-building story if you want to hear it on YouTube. So about 3 months, we sent out a newsletter, and over about 3 months' time around the world, 1.6 million, 1.5, because they dropped the price for us to 1,300,000, and help me, 9. But yeah, 6 weeks time. $1,391,173 was the final agreed upon price. Yahweh had been speaking to me 3-4 years and Danny with the number 3 and 7 over and over. So I knew that selling price had to be 3 and 7. I just knew it.
Yeah,
and
it was 6 weeks from the day we sent the newsletter out.
Okay.
Not 3 months, 6 weeks.
Okay, 6 weeks.
Yeah.
We've been in process for about 3 months total in, you know, this. But we didn't send the newsletter out right away. That was, I just wasn't clear enough. I'm sorry, hon. So 1.5 million more than we needed came in from around the world, cash. We knew we would not buy this place if we had to get a loan, because we knew that Yahweh doesn't have any trouble providing. And so he did it, and here we are. And then over the next 6 months after we, oh, and by the way, this is a fun little detail. The sellers, when we agreed on 7/03/07, the sellers agreed and signed the papers. We signed them that evening, and the sellers chose the closing date on July 3rd. And the date they chose just happened to be our wedding day, October 17th. Just happened to be, right? And the Lord was saying, happy anniversary. I heard your prayer when you got married 30 years ago. I heard you. And so we closed on October 17th and paid cash. And then the Lord, in 6 months, sent another approximately $600,000. We never did a fundraiser. You guys, come on. We didn't do one fundraiser. All we did was share the vision. We cast the vision. We cast the vision. That's all we did. And we trusted him. Let you do it. And Danny and I cannot take credit for this. This was just the Lord putting his grace on us to be able to do that. I don't want people to hear this and go, oh, it was because of your faith. Sorry. Or it was because you, no, sorry. We were just walking with the Lord, and he did it all. And he gave us what we needed for each day. So then we started building houses after the $600,000 came in. And every time somebody'd send money, we'd build another house. And we built another house. We have no debt, zero. Thank you, Lord. Never have. So you are sitting, walking on, sleeping in a farm that belongs to Yahweh 100%. That's why we call it our Father's farm. It belongs to him. It's his. And we just get to be stewards and try to take good care of it. And so that's a long story and a very little bitty short story. And as we had this place, we began to open it up really early on, like early in the very beginning, before the first year was over, to mostly kids that would come and live here. And we taught them how to do God encounters, which I'm going to talk about. Cindy's going to talk about what is a God encounter. And we taught them. We loved them. We just loved on them. You know, that was, and got them to the Father. I'd had a dream years ago. I was in agony over, Lord, what is my calling? You know, this was probably 30 years ago before the farm. What is my calling? I mean, I know I've got this, and I can do this, I can do that, I can whatever. But what's my calling? And it wouldn't let me go. And finally, Danny said, let's just go away. And we took a week off and went away and just sought the Lord and fasted and sought the Lord. And the last night, we had to leave the next day. I went to bed and I said, Lord, you haven't told me my calling. Before I go. And I'm begging and I fall asleep and I have a dream. And in this dream, I'm in a house, a really big house, and I hear a knock on the front door. I go to the door and I open the door and it's a mom with a little 7-year-old-ish boy. And the mom is in tears and she said, I don't know how to help him. I don't know how to help him. Can you help him? And I said, I can't, but I know somebody who can. And I took the little boy's hand, and she left, and I took the boy in, and he was terrified of me, and I had to be kind and gentle and slow. And finally, in the dream, he would let me sit beside him. And I said, and I started just talking to him. And finally, I asked him, I said, would you like to meet your father? And his eyes just looked up at me for the first time, and he said, you know my father? And I said, yeah, I know him really well. And I know that he loves you more than you can imagine. And you can meet him if you'd like to. Oh, I'd love to meet my father. And I said, okay. I said, Father, would you come? Would you come? And we both looked up, and we were sitting in a living room type room. And in walking down the hall, we could see the father. And he had on a flannel plaid shirt, rolled here, kindest eyes, white hair, glowing, but not scary, just gentle glow. He was just, oh, and he was smiling so big. And I could tell from his eyes he was as excited to meet this little boy as this little boy was to meet his daddy. And the little boy at one point looks at me as he's coming. He wasn't scary. He wasn't scary at all. And the little boy looks at me, that's my daddy? And I said, yeah, that's your daddy. Yeah. And he's, oh. And then the father comes and he stands in the door and he just stops right at the door and he just looks. He never said a word with his mouth, but he first looked at me and he said, without speaking, this is your calling. And then he looked at the little boy and he said, and I'm your daddy. And I'd love to hold you and hug you. The little boy jumps up, runs across the living room. He's holding onto my hand. He's dragging me with him. And then he stops. It was like all of a sudden he got scared. And I said, it's okay. Your daddy won't hurt you. This daddy won't hurt you ever. And he looked back at Father, and he looked back at me. And I said, here, I'll help you. And I took his hand. I was holding onto his hand, and I just placed his hand in the Father's hand, and I let go, and I took a step back. And the father looked at me and he said, this is your calling. Bring them to me and I'll heal them. I'll set them free. You just get them to me. That's my calling, to take every one of us by the hand. And some of you need to get on my back and do a piggyback, and it's okay. It's okay. And some of you need time. That's okay. But if I can get somebody to the Father or to Yeshua or to the Holy Spirit and let them touch him, you know, this thing, I know that everything will change. I know it. And regardless of what you've been through, regardless of how bad it's been, regardless of the level of abuse, from the worst case scenario to the least, he's enough. And that's a t-shirt. Do you really believe that Yahweh is enough? He's been saying that to me right now in my head constantly for the last month because of the battle. You know, I got my son-in-law fighting for his life. I'm 3 years fighting, right at 3 years fighting this battle with cancer. And the question is, and it always will be, do I really believe it? He said that to me. I heard it. Do you really, and he went like that, really believe that I'm enough? And that's the question everybody in this room, it doesn't matter what's going on, that's the question that he's asking right now. I believe he's asking it of the church across the earth. Because I know, if you don't know the answer to that question and you don't believe him, that he's enough, it's going to be very difficult as we continue in the clock ticking, the way it's clicking around the world right now and the events that are happening around the world. Because that is your solid rock.
That's right.
That he's enough. That whether I live or die, I'm the Lord's. And he is the only one that can tell my body to let go of my spirit. Yeah. And no demon and no cancer and no nothing can do that. Yeah. Just him. So, you're here to learn about the brain, and that's all great and wonderful, but you may or may not know that you're really here to learn a little more about Yahweh, and you will. You probably, most likely. I can't help myself and don't want to, because I want him to be in charge. I want him to be large and in charge and me small and obedient. So we're going to flow with him. I never know. And those of you who've been here before, you know that that's true. Because I have a general idea, I believe, what the Lord said, but he has every right to change it. And he has done it. You know, I get up here some mornings, and as I'm walking up here, he says, put your notes up. Let's go hit this way. And he gets to be the orchestra leader, the conductor, right? So we're going to follow that plan again. I'm not the best at clocks, and by the way, my clock's off, so y'all are in real trouble because it says it's 10 till 9. I like it. Don't change it. No. I will try to remember breaks. Especially if I see people getting up to go to the bathroom, I go, oh, okay, it's time. So I'll do my best to remember breaks. And Toby, my grandson Toby, he's really good at reminding me of breaks. So we will probably today, because we have so much to get you ready for what's coming, we probably won't break for lunch until 1. So if you have snacks or something, you might want to, or there's some back there, you might want to consider that we might have a late lunch. We'll see. I have a certain amount of material that I know that I need to get to for us to finish by Friday. And I'm going to do my best to do that. So again, if you have questions, I'm going to ask that you write them down. And then, because there's a good chance I'll answer them as we're going forward, and that will save us some time. But if you don't get the answer to that question that you write down, make sure you ask it. You know, and some people don't like that microphone, so they may have the same question but don't want to ask it. So be sure and ask it if you don't get the answer, okay? All right, I think we're ready then to jump in. Your brain on joy. You have a notebook. You skip, go to page 5. The first 4 pages in your notebook are an overview of this whole week. Because I thought it'd be really helpful in the future as a refresher for me to pull out some high points and put it on those first 4 pages for you. So we will cover all those pages as we go throughout the week. But we're going to start on page 5. Now, I want to say this as well. I wrote this so that you can read it and not have to have a teacher, right? So at the last conference in November, some of the feedback was, well, you just read the notes. I didn't need you to teach. You know, I didn't need you. And that was my point, you know, so that you can go teach us to other people. You can have this when you leave here, because I promise you, you're not going to retain maybe 10% probably of what you hear. And sometimes it'll feel like a fire hydrant. So this way you have it to take home and read it again. And please do. Please do, because I believe that if we understand how Yahweh made our brains to function and we partner with that way, that we will find life so much easier to navigate. That's been my experience. So that's why we're going to look at this marvelous thing called the brain and how it works. But before we actually look at the anatomy of the brain, which we'll probably do a little more of Thursday and Friday, we'll do some of it as we go, but I want to set the foundation. And the foundation of your brain being healthy is something we call joy. And it's not laughter. It's not happiness. That is not what joy is according to the Bible and according to neuroscience in relation to your brain. Joy according to the Bible and scriptural teaching and neuroscience, brain science, is the definition of joy is somebody's glad to be with me. That's joy. When you know that somebody's glad to be with you, Your brain responds in amazing ways. We'll look at that. It releases hormones. It releases this feeling of I'm good, I'm well, I'm safe. It's called shalom. All is well. It releases that into your brain. If you don't believe that somebody is glad to be with you, you're going to live a nightmare. Your brain will go into ultra chaos mode and crisis. So number one in your life, pray. If you don't feel that, ask the Lord to show you what's blocking you from believing that. To bring someone into your life that you can feel safe with, that you do are able to believe that they're glad to be with me. And we're going to look at all the ways that you believe that. Now, if you see, look at this, your brain on joy here. That is, I just love that picture because it makes me joyful. I look at that baby, and that baby is so glad to be with whomever she's looking at. And the way we know it, not a word is spoken here, right? You see this baby's facial expression, eyes, gesture of the body. This baby is so glad to be with mom or dad or whoever, and also feels that that person is glad to be with that baby. It has to be both for it to affect the brain. I have to know that John is glad to be here. And by the way, my brain is searching 7 times a second this room to identify who's glad to be with me. And I can pick them out. It's not even conscious. It's subconscious. It happens. And I've paid attention through the years that when I'm teaching a, hi Steve, boy, you're like so glad to be here right now. Wow. When I'm teaching a tough subject that I know people are like, stop, you know, I won't even think about it, but my brain will go to boom, boom, boom. I will know already who's really glad to be here because that's how important this is to your brain. And if I don't find somebody that will feedback with me, my brain will push, and we'll talk about the process, push a 911, and it'll start sending out hormones and call the fire department and all kinds of things in here. Because that's how critical it is that we find people, that we are with people who are glad to be with us. And I probably don't even have to convince y'all, because if you've lived long enough and not lived on an island all by yourself, you've experienced times with people that weren't glad to be with you, and you couldn't wait to get away. Or you couldn't wait to straighten them out, or however you respond, right? So, and you've also been in situations where you were hurting and really, really hurting, and somebody came and they were so glad to be with you that you were able to make it through that storm, right? So we're going to look at a lot more in detail, because this is critical. If you're a Christian, and if you're not, you can be, and the Lord will tell me, and will probably, he did before, done it a number of times, preach the gospel around it. But Lord, these are all Christians. I said, preach the gospel. All right. And then somebody gave their life to the Lord. So if you are a believer in Christ and a follower of Christ, you don't just believe, but you're following, it's critical that you're Christ-like. And Christ was always glad to be with sinners. He actually, Luke 15, he made them his best friends. That's his message. They're not just my friend. I don't just eat with them. Tax collectors, sinners. I make them part of my family. I'm happy to be with them. And he modeled that. The only people that he didn't model that with was the Pharisees and scribes, because they were hurting his sheep. So, anyway, That's why this teaching is probably, of everything you're going to hear this week, probably the most critical. Joy building. And what that looks like. All right. So, here we go. Your notes. All of us have a limit or capacity or ability as to how much joy we can possess. So you have a container Yahweh built inside of you, and it's different. That container grows by being exercised. It grows larger. So the more you practice being glad to be with someone, the larger your capacity grows. And the opposite is true. The more you withdraw and become, should I warn? Yeah. Okay. Y'all can handle it. It's college, right? So those of you that are introverts, it's dangerous to use that as an excuse to isolate. You just learn it. That's how Yahweh made you. So you are going to need more time alone with him or with one person. You know, introverts doesn't mean they always want to be alone, but they tend to be the people that don't like this room, this crowd, you know, if they're all focused on them. But introverts still have that mandate from the Lord that we love Yahweh, we love our neighbor, just as we love ourselves. So we can't forget that we are to reach out and be with and impact. But it might be one-on-one, and that's great. And extroverts tend to invite 20 people home, and introverts tend to invite one, two maybe at the most. It's okay. But it's not a license for you to do what you want to do. We always have to do what the Lord's called us to do. And sometimes he calls introverts to step across that line and be an extrovert for half a day or a day, so he gets to be large and in charge, not us. All right, and as you do that, your capacity will increase. So it's important, as well. Okay, so that capacity determines how much upset, trauma, pain, uncomfortableness you're able to experience and still remain relational. That's why that capacity is so important. If you have, stick my hand in it, then I'd laugh and y'all have to, what? So if your capacity for joy is this size and you have something huge blow up in your life that exceeds this capacity, what that means is you're not going to be able to maintain your true relational self. You will become mad, sad, depressed, isolate yourself, etc., whatever your pattern is. And so that's why this is critical, that we have a really large capacity for joy. Because that balances us when big things happen, when scary things happen, when our faith gets shaken, etc., or challenged, or whatever, right? So there's many brain studies that prove that people get healed in communities. Not just any kind of community, but a specific community. A community that has deep bonds of love. And that's not just the Bible. That's brain science now telling us that. If we truly want to become whole and healed and Christ-like in the way we love each other, we have to do it in a community where the weak and the strong live together. And where the strong, more mature, respond to the weakness of others with gentleness and kindness. Yes. And that's proven by science. I love it. And if that community has bonds of fear instead of bonds of love, the opposite happens. People get more traumatized, more wounded, more. And that fear, let me just talk about that for a second. The community could have a bond of love, but I come into that community with fear, because that has been my challenge my whole life. Fear is the thing. We all have our thorn in the flesh. That happens to be mine. I think I was born with it. I think it happened in the womb. And so I fought it. So if I bring that fear of, I don't know, Christy, she's going to reject me. I just know it. I'm just waiting. As soon as I say the wrong thing, it's over. My friendship with her is done. If I bring that into this relationship here, I am going to not be able to receive her attunement and her love. I won't. It goes through my filter, and that filter distorts the message that she's trying to send me. And I'll tell you this, it's called, we'll talk about it, I don't know if we'll get to it today, the VLE. This is like, this one upset, on our response forms last time, this was the one that most people commented on, the VLE. It triggered people, some people got mad, some people were like, help me understand more. This is a big deal. It's in our brains. Yahweh put it there. That means it has a purpose, and its intent is to help us make sense out of life. Verbal logical explainer, VLE. It's in your notes, believe me. We're going to go over it probably a good bit. And it's a response wired into your brain to life. And that response is meant to bring peace to you, to help you process what's going on, because your brain wants to process life. It's wired that way. Yahweh wants, but he wants us to do it with him and other people that are safe. Well, when you bring your fear into a community or your implicit memory, we'll look at that again. That's memories that you don't even realize you're remembering. They're behind a wall, but they're bleeding through that wall and bringing what you believe to be true. Your dad was mad, angry, not safe, hurt you at any, there was no reason, etc. That's behind that wall. You don't even realize that it's bleeding through and affecting your present day perceptions. What you see in front of you is it's affecting that filter and clogging it so that what you see is not true. Christy really does love me. She doesn't even have any thought of rejecting me or abandoning me. I can know that in my left brain, but if I have this history of friends betraying me or whatever, it's going to come out and it's going to be, my brain will do it and I won't even know it's doing it. And then I'll tell myself a story. See? And I'll watch like crazy. See? Look at that. She walked right by me and didn't even acknowledge me. Huh. She went right over there to Sue and sat down by her, and I saved her a seat over there. I mean, my brain will go, and you believe it's true. And the bad thing about VLEs is that if you believe that story you've told yourself, you will not be able to change that belief until that person, Christy, comes and repents, confesses, and makes it right. That's how it works. That's why it's so dangerous. And because that's an impossible situation, because Christy's done nothing wrong. She didn't even know that I'm thinking all this. But yet, I'm going to do this. I'm going to put that wall up. Okay, she's not safe. And then the next time, I'll be the one, and I'll blame it on her. And I'll blame it on her the next time and the next time until I've got a Fort Knox built around me meant to keep me safe from being hurt by Christy. So anytime you recognize that you are protecting yourself, that ought to be alert number one. My VLE is in action. It's working. It's telling me a story. Why? And ask yourself, why do I feel like I have to protect myself right now? And ask the Lord to help you see the truth and discover reality and not what you're telling yourself. But we will talk about that again a good bit, because it's a big deal in your life. We do it way more than we realize. It's called confabulation. Your brain confabulates. I love that word. I love to say it. I love typing it. Confabulation. You confabulate our brain. And it's not intentional. It's not conscious. That's what's scary. It's subconscious. Now, again, it was meant for good. It was meant for my brain to be able to assess a situation and process it and tell me, write a summary of that situation and how to navigate it. That's what its intention is. But when it's fed wrong information, it does the same thing. It looks at the situation, it looks at the facts, and then it tells me a summary. Okay? All right, so, again, you're going to hear me say this who knows how many times. Joy means somebody's glad to be with you. If you really want joy, that's what your brain's looking for, and everybody's brain's looking for that, without exception. Some of you might be so terrified to allow that to be happen that you deny it, but it's still true, right? And the way we determine if somebody's glad to be with us is by their tone of voice, their facial expressions, their body language. 80-whatever% of communication is nonverbal. And I've encountered the Lord since 1988, where he just saved my life massively. And I can't think of one single time where Yeshua, when he spoke to me, that it came out of his mouth with words. Now, I don't have one time where I saw his face speaking words. He looked in my eyes and he spoke. And he's like the epitome of this truth. We do that with each other. Our brain is constantly communicating with your brain, whoever you're talking with. And it doesn't pay a lot of attention to your words. It pays a lot, capital, of your tone of voice, your facial expression, your body language. If you're like, I love you. I love you, Sue. No, that Susan, she's going to do that. She's going to laugh. Like, you what? Really? So it really, really, really matters. It matters what you're telling yourself. I have a saying. I should have done this on a T-shirt. Pay attention to what you're paying attention to. Because most of us aren't paying attention to what we're paying attention to in our brains. We just let whatever go through and we don't stop it. We just let it. Negative thoughts about ourselves, about other people, about the future, whatever. And we don't stop it. And that's contrary to what Paul said. That we're to take every thought captive under the obedience of Christ. We are to pay attention to what we're telling ourselves up here. And we're to do something with it, because your brain doesn't have that ability on its own. That's your spirit telling your brain, oh, nope, whatever things are lovely, of good report, I'm going to think on these things. But right now you're thinking negative about Christy. No, red X. Your brain thinks in images first. So when I find my brain thinking about something I don't want it thinking about, or talking to myself in ways I don't want it to, whatever that image might be, I will see myself put a red X, the blood of Christ, over that negative, ungodly or unkind or whatever thought. And then I will replace it with the truth, things that are beautiful and lovely and of good report, etc. It takes practice. It takes work. And Americans don't really like that too much. We like to be comfortable and we like to just kind of sail. I'm telling you, that's not the way to live. It's a fight. The Lord told me the other day, I'll tell you, these handouts in this front part of the notebook. I had these in November, and I thought, I need to take the time and add more scripture, make it more easily read, et cetera, et cetera. I love doing that. I like to do things with excellence, like scripture says. And so I worked on it for weeks, and I was so happy. I finally got it done, and I got it done in time to get printed, and I saved it on my little stick thing to give to Cindy because we were going to try to print it on her printer to see if it was a better print than ours. And so I handed it to Danny to go print. And there was nothing there but one blank page. I had 73 pages. One blank page. I'm like, how is that possible? So I do the search on my laptop. All that would come up is one blank page. I searched every way I could think of. And I said, okay, it's all right. It's all right. Cindy's got the stick thing. So I asked, she went and got it. She brought it to me. Opened it up. One blank page. Don't understand it. I can't imagine how that happened. I don't know. Because it's not easy to delete 73 pages of a document, right? Anyway, and I've been doing this for a few years, so I don't know. But so what you have here, I almost cried because it was beautiful. I had done graphics. I'd done all kinds of fun stuff and lots of scripture. But thankfully, we had this one from November saved downstairs on the other computer. So I pulled it up, and I had one day kind of go through and catch some of the typos and et cetera from last time. So how am I getting to this? How did I get to that? Anyway, I don't know. But next time around, Lord willing, I will get to, I hate redoing things. That's just not my, but I'm going to because I love y'all and I love excellence. So I will redo this when I get time. But we're thankfully we have this. Yeah. I don't know what we would have done. We would have done something, but I don't know. Okay. All right. Communication. We've only done one paragraph. We're in trouble. I've only done one. Communication happens simultaneously on two levels. Number one, you are listening to my words because I'm the one talking. And you're following my words, I hope. And number two, the right hemisphere of your brain and the right hemisphere of my brain are communicating based on my voice tone, my facial expressions, and my gestures. That's also true when you're talking to somebody one-on-one and you look left eye to left eye. So you are gathering more information than I am right now because I'm the one speaking, you're the one receiving. But that doesn't mean my brain's not taking in information from you. It is, big time. 7 times every second, it's checking in to see if you're attuned to me. If I see that people, half the room's falling asleep or 3 people are falling asleep, I'll go, break time, get the coffee out or whatever. But you, as you're looking at me, that's why face-to-face is so important when you want to communicate for real. Texting is terrible communication. Think about it. You can't see you can't hear their voice tone. You can't see their face, your gestures. All you got some words on a screen. So, anytime we're trying to communicate, especially if it's a problem or a reconciliation or anything, if you want to be successful, it needs to be face to face with a person. Now, the other truth is, if you're with me for a little while and we're communicating and I happen to be angry, it won't be long until you start getting agitated, uncomfortable, and maybe even mad at me for being angry. Because our brains will do something. We're going to talk about this called mindsight. Our brains communicate and begin to mirror each other. And that's one reason we tell our kids, don't hang out with so-and-so. because birds of a feather will flock together and they become a bad influence. And they go, oh, but I'm going to save them. No, you're not. You know, I think we've all probably had some of those experiences. Generally, especially if children, because they're young, and teens, they're young and aren't able to stand for what's right. All right? So my brain not only checks 7 times a second to see if you're attuned to me, but my brain will register, take a picture of, absorb the expression that's on my face in 40 milliseconds. That means when somebody meets me, before I even realize, can say their name, they've already registered how I feel. That's why smiling is such a big deal. Smiling is a big deal. And we love to look at people who are smiling. Think about it. Somebody's got a frowny, permanent frowny face. How much do you like looking at them? Right, right. One of my favorite things has been when I pick people up at the airport to go early and sit in that chair and watch people get off the plane and greet each other outside that gate. I love that because most of the time, they're happy, they're smiling, they're grabbing and hugging, and it just makes me smile and feel good and all that. But then the once in a while you see the ones that are, you know, and that, I don't look at them. No, over here. So it's amazing what your brain is thinking all the time. Okay. For an infant, because at 40 milliseconds, our brains are registering what that person that they're looking at feels about them. For infants, this actually shapes the way their brain grows, the anatomy in their brain. If there's a lot of joy from that parent, that caretaker, then their brain structure will be large and connected to joy. I'm glad to be with you. They'll be connected, want to be connected with people. But the same happens if that caregiver is angry or depressed, etc. That baby's brain will model itself, form itself after what it's registering on the caretaker's face. Yeah. That's why it's so important as you're raising your babies and your grandchildren that you get that smile on your face, happy to be with you, even when you're changing their poopy diaper. I actually had somebody that had a stronghold of just this fear of being a disappointment. And we did tons of sessions, couldn't get to it, Lord, you know, weeks and still wasn't there. And finally I just said, I don't know. Lord, you know, would you just come? Yeah, I wish I'd have thought of that at the beginning. And all of a sudden this woman says, it wasn't a woman, it was a man. He said, oh my goodness, I'm seeing a baby on a changing table and my mom is changing this baby's diaper, and she's going, ooh, yuck, you stink. That was the stronghold. A disappointment, rejection, pain, hurt. That baby took it on, and he said, who is? I said, you want to ask the Lord who that baby is? And he just broke down crying. It's me. It's me. And he carried that his whole life, feeling like people felt that way about him. Anytime he made a mistake. So he was driven to be perfect. That ain't going to happen. So I did that with my babies, but they don't have that. Not everybody takes that in like he did, right? So if you're sitting there going, man, I went, ooh, yeah, this stinks. Don't go, oh, I ruined my child. Yeah. So, where's my little clicker here? Let's see if I can. Isn't that fun? I love that. Makes joy means someone is glad to be with me. Either their face, tone of voice, or body language. Gestures tell me that. All right. Joy addresses the number one need of all humanity, and that number one need is belonging. We all, everybody in this room, your core driving force is to get to a place where you actually feel like you belong here. Here, I'm not talking about on the earth. I'm talking about wherever you are in life. I belong here. I belong in this relationship. I belong with this group of people. I belong in this ministry or occupation or relationship, whatever it might be. And if you don't have that, your brain is in crisis. And your brain will be depressed, and your brain won't want to be here. And that's behind suicide. And there are all kinds of reasons that people don't feel like they belong. And most people want to do this and blame Tammy. Tammy, it's your fault that I don't feel like I belong. That's human nature. Adam and Eve did it in the garden. That woman that you, Adam blamed God, that you gave me, blamed the woman. She gave me the fruit and I ate it. Excuse me? Did she force it down your throat? No. So that's in our flesh nature to blame. But the truth is, if we don't feel like we belong, we have to look inside us first. Because you'll never believe you belong if you have a stronghold or a belief and your VLE is telling you that story. You don't belong. You don't belong. After all, look at how so-and-so treated me. You can't. You've got to deal with, why do I feel like I don't belong? And without blaming somebody else, but finding out inside of you what's hurt. There's some wounds there. There's some beliefs there that are not true. And joy is at the heart of belonging. You'll never feel like you belong unless you know that somebody's glad to be with you. And if you are joy-centered, then you will feel like you're living in a nightmare, like I said. You will have low joy. Your brain will hate your life. Joy is what ignites the transformation process in our lives. If you want to be transformed, it has to be attached to this belief that somebody's glad to be with me. And first and foremost, Yahweh's glad to be with me. First and foremost. And secondarily, your family or friends, or whoever it is you're doing life with. John 15:11, Yeshua said, "These things I've spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made full." So we have to taste and see that the Lord is good and that he's glad to be with us and he loves us even when we're in sinning. You know, I grew up in church and I was taught that Adam and Eve had to leave the garden because God's too holy to be in the presence of sinful people. Well, that truth set in motion in my life this belief that if I sin, God doesn't want to be with me and he's going to just kick me out, so I got to be perfect. That's been one of my strongholds that I had to work on with the Lord's help. And it's just not true. When you read Genesis 1-3, it's clear Yahweh drove Adam and Eve out of the garden to protect them. Yeah. He knew that if he left them there, they would eat from the tree of life and live in a sinful state the rest of their lives, and there'd be no hope for them. Because that tree of life gave eternal life, and he knew he couldn't trust them. He told them to eat from that tree in the beginning, and they didn't do it. They chose the knowledge. Adam wanted power. He wanted knowledge, and knowledge is power. He wanted to be in control. And that's where we get that gene from. were born with it. Ask any two-year-old who's in control, right? So we've got the Lord Yeshua himself said, I'm glad to be with you. And I want that truth to be in you so much that you're overflowing, that it would be made full, that truth, first towards him and then with each other. All right, both the Bible and neuroscience understand joy as a relational experience. Joy is not a result of getting a new car. Joy is not a result of somebody doing what you want them to do. That's called happiness. And that's, happiness is based on things, not relationship. Joy is always based on relationship. Always, always, always. You can't have joy without relationship. And this is what neuroscience says as well as the Bible. Joy is, here's some definitions. Joy is the excitement around the exchange of everything that's good for life. It's relational, it's contagious, and it transforms. Joy starts with a smile, and everybody can smile. Joy helps our brains feel better, and it's better than any health food, and I appreciate that. Joy reduces stress, has more social impact than looking sexy.
Hallelujah.
Joy. So we have, that made us all feel better. Oh, joy improves our immune system more than exercise. I like that one a lot. Joy protects marriages, raises brighter, more resilient children. Joy improves our resiliency after disasters. Joy spreads and helps transform lives. John 15:11, there. These things I've spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be made full. All right. Turn this page. The joy of the Lord is my strength. Okay, there's three things necessary for joy to be developed and to grow. Number one, a multi-generational community. That means the old and the young doing life together in community. Now, we'll talk about that in a minute. Number two, a lifestyle of encountering Yahweh. Number three, relational brain skills. Now, this is not just Bible right here. This is neuroscience talking to you, these three things. And they say a lifestyle of encountering a God that loves. That's how they say it. I just couldn't do that, because I don't believe in a God, because you can have Buddha, you can have... But the truth is, brain science proves that even if you're worshiping Buddha, if you believe Buddha is love, it'll have the same impact on your brain, right? But the problem is, you know, what is your belief about that God? That's true for Christians. What's your belief about Yahweh? Do you see him as a God of love? Or do you see him as a dictator? Or somebody like Santa Claus, he's making a list, checking it twice to see if been naughty or nice. Is that how you view him? So that's not going to grow joy if so, and you're not going to be able to spread joy if that's true. And we're going to look at the relational brain skills. There's 19 of them in a little bit to help you know what those are. So if you want to have joy and be able to grow joy in other people, reproduce after your own kind, because we're told to reproduce after our kind, then these three things have to be part of your life. Okay. Do y'all need a break? Break time? All right. Yay.